Thank you for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly news report, bringing you alternative and undercover current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. My name is Alex DeBoer.
I'm Sam Jones.
And I'm Lyndon Wong. It's Thursday, October 11th at 5 o'clock p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkamiam Niminam speaking Musqueam people. Today's show will start out with an examination of the effects of polling on Vancouver's 2018 election with UBC political science professor Richard Johnston.
We then have an interview with Tamara Levy of the UBC School of Law. She talks with the News Collective about the frequency of wrongful convictions in Canada in honor of the National Wrongful Conviction Day, which took place last week on October 2nd.
Lastly, we have a report on the city's new initiative to increase voter turnout through more accessible voting options. Reporters Sam Jones and Lyndon Wong, who are here with me now, went to a couple mobile voting sites this week, yesterday in fact, to chat with voters on how integral the city's new mobile voting options have been to them being able to actually cast their ballot.
First, though, let's go to our interview with UBC political science professor Richard Johnston. Professor Johnston holds the Canada Research Chair in Public Opinion, Elections, and Representation at UBC. He specializes in electoral systems, party systems, and parties.
Yeah, and so I spoke with Professor Johnston today about the effects poll results might have on Vancouver's 2018 municipal election. So as Charlie Smith of the Georgia Strait writes, the NDP machine is telling people on doorsteps that progressives have no choice but to get behind its candidate, the rather colorless Kennedy Stewart. So the reason Smith is saying that people feel pressured to vote for independent mayoral candidate Kennedy Stewart is because polls, and in this election, the polling has mostly come from one company, which is Research Co., run by Mario Canseco. These polls have found that independent candidate Kennedy Stewart is leading the race for mayor among decided voters. And second among decided voters is Ken Sim. But the issue here is that a lot of people are undecided still. And so if you're undecided, but you see that the progressive candidate is first to the conservative candidate, who's second, you might decide, well, the safest thing to do is vote for Kennedy Stewart rather than pick someone else I might prefer. So I spoke with Professor Johnston about the influence these polls have and whether polling itself could be an affront to our democracy in a way. So let's go to that interview now and see what Richard said.
My name is Richard Johnston. I'm a professor of political science at UBC Vancouver.
So polls that have been done during Vancouver's 2018 election period, which have primarily been done by Research Co., have placed independent mayoral candidate Kennedy Stewart in the lead among decided voters. And the Georgia
My name is Richard Johnston. I'm a professor of political science at UBC Vancouver. My name is Richard Johnston.
Polls that have been done during Vancouver's 2018 election period, which have primarily been done by Research Co., have placed independent mayoral candidate Kennedy Stewart in the lead among decided voters. And the Georgia Strait's Charlie Smith recently wrote an article which discussed how these polls may be scaring people away from voting for Vancouver's other progressive mayoral candidate, Shauna Sylvester. So from the perspective of someone who is specialized in political science, can you comment on whether or not Charlie Smith's theory that people might be voting for Kennedy Stewart out of fear, whether that's possible?
I don't think fear is the word exactly. And I don't know that Charlie really means that. But if people are looking for a signal about who on the left side of the spectrum to support, given that there's there's more than one candidate, then poll information is potentially strategically useful information. It suggests where you need to coordinate in order to be most effective. Of course, that raises the question of whether the poll is any good, but in the absence of other information, it's something to go on.
Right. And why do you say that you don't think people would be voting out of fear particularly?
Well, if by fear he means concern that by voting for Sylvester, people will be worried that they're splitting the vote on the left and thus facilitating a victory by somebody on the right. So it's fear of what in academic terms we would call coordination failure. I don't know that it's necessarily fear in the sense of, you know, fear and loathing, anxiety for one's soul and that sort of thing.
Yes, good point. Fear might be a bit hyperbolic of a word choice.
Yes.
So there have been a lot of online polls done during this election cycle. Some parties have been putting out their own polls, for example. Mm-hmm. How can people in Vancouver know if a poll or pollster is credible?
Well, that's a tough one. I mean, one thing you want to do is ask yourself whether indeed it is a poll that's being put out by a party. Parties will put out polls that are favorable to themselves in general and suppress others. Am I getting through, by the way?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, I wasn't sure whether I was. So that's an issue. At the end of the day, this is a sort of task that really falls on the journalistic community, right? In the sense that they should not report polls as gospel all by themselves, but instead should investigate the sources of the poll. And if they can't track down a website, can't track down some kind of report on the features of the poll, they should consider not publicizing it, but at a minimum, publicizing it in a way that raises questions about its provenance. But I think that individual voters are going to really struggle to do this, right? You hear something on a passing radio reference, and by the time you realize that you should be listening, it's already over. So this is where the journalistic community, I would say especially the print community, can step up. Mm. They have to be, in some sense, our trustees in sorting this stuff out.
Right. And then I was also wondering about the difference between public polling, so polling conducted by our own government, and how that might be better at compiling credible election stats and maybe communicating those to voters than private pollsters. Do you think if we had public polls, there would be less confusion over what is credible information?
Not necessarily. I think, first of all, it's not clear to me that the government has more credibility than private sources as such. I think the key, frankly, is that there be more than one poll, that the polls be conducted by different outfits, and that there be reasonable clarity about the nature of the poll, about what its mode is, for example, online versus telephone, something about its sampling frame, if there is one, something about the online panel, if that's what it is. It would be good to know what the question is, how representative the sample is of the population, and whether there are other questions that might have led voters towards one direction or another on the vote intention question. So really what we should be looking for is information about polls gathered by entities that are not themselves the initiator or the sponsor of the poll, but who can compile basically a log of information about all the polls that are published. But having a public poll, I mean, first of all, a public poll would be susceptible to all of the vagaries that private polls are. And in a sense, the public poll, I mean, if you're really talking about a government poll, then in some sense, you would be bringing arguments about the proper wording of questions and that sort of stuff into a public sphere of a sort, but not necessarily one that would be the best way to digest such arguments.
Hmm. And in this 2018 Vancouver election, do you think that there have been enough polls? Because I've only really been referring to polls from Research Co.
I would say there have not been enough. I can't say that I have much sense beyond that particular poll of anything. My intuition all along has been Stewart is likely the front runner, if only because he was one of the earliest to declare, and he already was a public figure with experience in electoral politics. But that was a surmise based on just the situation and the person, not on any poll information. there is a sort of mantra of disliking polls, but polls are one of those things. The only antidote to a poll you don't like is another poll.
Right. Well, and with Research Co. being kind of the only company most people know who are putting out credible polls in this 2018 election, do you think they're doing a good job of explaining their methodology, like the specific questions they're asking and how they're getting their information?
I can't say. I did not see any detail. I mean, I cannot recall to mind detail from a news story, and I haven't actually gone onto a website to see what they say. What I would say is that in general, not speaking of Strategic Council in particular, or rather Research Co. in particular, I would say that the description of polls by Canadian polling outfits these days is actually pretty dismal. I've been kind of keeping track of polls on federal vote intention and putting them through some analyses. But what I'm struck by is that we don't seem to be taking very seriously the reporting requirements for polls, at least in the press. You can always find a press release. At least I have always been able to find a press release for federal polls. But even the press release is not always as informative as I would like.
Right. So you're saying the press isn't doing as good a job as it could of giving the details about the poll itself?
Some of it's the press, but also I'm not struck that the polling firms are as forthright as they might be about their methods either.
Right.
They sort of regard these things as secret sauces.
Mm. And so I guess the fear is that it's so important the way you ask a question that if it's phrased in a, you know, slightly different way to being phrased in a different way, it could totally change people's responses. Like, is that the fear, or is that the concern that
that is a concern. That's one of them. So, yes, we know that questions and answers are not unrelated. How related they are depends on how crystallized the opinion is likely to be, how much, as it were, practice people have had at forming it. And so, for example, polls about federal elections, there's a fair amount of variation. On the other hand, most of the actors are familiar to people, familiar enough at least, so that they can at least give sort of ritual responses that broadly correspond to their long-term preferences. But when you're talking about an election like this one, where there's just lots and lots of candidates, mm-hmm. many of them are very new to the scene, right? We're having unprecedented turnover mm-hmm. in municipal elections. So this is a situation in which opinions are likely not to have been crystallized. And so you could see that response would be shaped by considerations in the question or in the questionnaire that are not terribly germane to the choice, like whose name comes first or whose name comes last.
So
whether, you know, how many names are named, that sort of thing, whether there's any indication of a party affiliation.
Right. And so by that same token, because there are so many new candidates running, so few incumbents in this election, wouldn't polls be more likely to affect undecided voters than they normally would be?
Yes. I mean, you're talking about a field of candidates, many of whom are simply unknown to the public. I mean, I couldn't name all of the mayoral candidates. I could mm-hmm. probably name about half a dozen of them, but it'd take me, you know, a minute or so to dredge them up. Mm-hmm. And while I'm not a city politics person, I am a political scientist, and so I'm probably at the high end of the information continuum here.
You would think,
And then on top of that, that's just about questionnaires and questions. Of questionnaires, you know, one of the issues is how many questions has the respondent been asked before you get to the vote intention? And it's sometimes what you may get is a menu of questions which, as it were, prime certain considerations at the expense of others. And this can have an impact on how candidates get ordered in their minds, although at this point, in general, there's not a lot of basis with which to distinguish among most of the candidates, although some of them certainly are distinct. So that's one thing. But then another thing is just what's the sample, you know, and what's the mode? If it's an online mode, which is increasingly common, and it is largely the future of survey research. Mm-hmm. If it's an online mode, then people are reading a menu, right? Mm-hmm. Will all the candidates be on the menu? What will be their order? We know that, for example, when you have a visual mode, like an online questionnaire, there tends to be a bit of a privilege for the first name you see, the name at the top of the list, and then you might sort of start to lose the message as you go down the list. That's actually one of the reasons why the ballot is being randomized this year. But you have similar sort of effects on online polls. Mm-hmm. With telephone polls, people are a little bit biased towards the last name they heard. And so an interesting question would be, have these names been randomized in either mode? Mm. So there's something. Online mode, you got to be able to read. Mm-hmm. Telephone, no, you don't. Online mode, you can actually be a little bit more reflective. Telephone, you tend to, the performance tends to be what we call satisficing. You will often give simply the same answer to a battery of questions because it's easy.
Right.
So you're a little bit less likely to do that if you're online. So these are the kind of contingencies that are actually quite well known. They're part of the lore and the analysis of survey data. Most of the companies know this. But you wouldn't expect or require a company to report what the research says about, e.g., order biases in lists. But it's the sort of thing where it would be good if someone on the polling beat of especially a print outlet or maybe a visual outlet like TV, would just keep a running brief on these things.
Right. But so you're talking about all these differences between mediums of polling through online versus phone, for example. So that people tend to react differently to these different polling mediums. But is the difference crucial? Like, will it make a big difference enough that...
Well, it can be, and it would be interesting to see just how many polls have been published by how many different firms. And with what results? I mean, I suggest if you're interested in what this stuff might look like, go to the 538.com. You know what this is? Nate Silver's website with a lot of information about politics, sports, and all the rest of it. And he's one of the original. He's one of the original polling nerds. The 538. It's just a number. 538. Mm-hmm. That's the number of votes in the U.S. Electoral College. So it's American mm-hmm. stuff. But if you just happen to take a look at the 538's tracking of polls for the so-called generic ballot for the upcoming congressional election in the U.S., what's striking is that within a matter of a day, a same day or one or two days, you can get polls that differ in the percentage Democrat or Republican by 8 to 10 percentage points. Mm. You know, that's a lot. So in that situation, what somebody like 538 does, or what I do in work that I'm doing with Canadian polls, or Eric Grenier, who was the poll guy on CBC, is you think about ways of trying to burn through this variation, which most of it simply has to be noise, right? It's noise produced by sampling error. The smaller the sample, the more variable the results will be. It's noise produced by differences amongst firms in how they word questions, differences among firms about how they treat people who don't answer the question, and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And so you try to come up with some sort of signal out of this noise by some kind of averaging. Right. Now, in the municipal context, there aren't that many polls. And maybe not as much information, unlikely to be as much information about the firms as you would have in a high-volume U.S. electoral context.
Right.
But the more information you can get about these firms and the more you can make comparisons amongst firms, the more you can potentially find, as I say, the signal in the noise.
Right.
And to go back where you started from, we care about this stuff because especially in these sort of what are really low information elections like municipal ones, People just don't know as much about them as you do about provincial or federal elections, and the choices are often more complex given the way we organize the council and so on. So that in these kind of low information situation, bits of information that seem to stand out, like the most recent poll, can be quite influential.
Right. Another interesting thing Charlie Smith brought up in that Georgia Strait article was the effect that, or the meaning of attack ads and how they reflect on internal polling done by parties. So, so he said perhaps one way of knowing how a party has evaluated its competitors, how close they are in the race, is the type or amount of attack ads they're doing. Do you think that's a relevant way to kind of figure out how close parties are to one another in the race?
It absolutely is. You know, think about this. You've got an advertising budget. It's like an investment, right? You want to get the maximum return on your investment. That means you don't want to waste your money. So you do need to strategize about where the money is best spent. And in point of fact, even though attack ads can be unpleasant, they're generally speaking more informative than the others. You know, you think about an advertisement that a candidate places about himself or herself. You know, it's greatest things in sliced bread, Matt and the Idol good looks, competence, blah, 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 blah. It's all positives. And it's positives that are almost impossible to verify. They're just puffery. Whereas if you're actually going to attack an opponent, it helps if what you're saying is the truth, or at least an approximation to the truth, because there will be pushback if it's not, including from the media. So in the grand scheme of things, actually, negative advertising is both quite useful in figuring out where to put the candidates on the landscape, but it's also, from the point of view of interpretation of what's going on, a pretty good sense of who's worried about whom.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, that's a proxy for intelligence that they've gathered somewhere about this, and chances are that intelligence comes from a poll.
Right. And the party's internal polls are probably pretty accurate, do you think?
We'll never know, because they don't release them, right?
That's true.
And if, you know, the pollster for the winning side will certainly advertise his or her competence.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the point is, there's a strong incentive towards accuracy.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
This is a quite different kind of client relationship from the typical client relationship in the business, where the client often really doesn't know much, not always sure why they're buying this information, and they're sort of prisoners of the pollster. Party campaigns tend to have shrewder, you know, more inquisitive, more strategically minded people doing it. So they may be harder to BS them, but at the end of the day, they may not necessarily know what's really going on in the sausage factory either, but they're probably pretty well placed to ask the right questions. And
right.
So most of the time, I would say party polls are probably pretty good, but I'll tell you, there is a tendency, we believe, you know, basically on the basis of anecdotes piled up over the years, there's some reason to think that parties do tilt their polling towards making themselves feel good, sometimes at the expense of their true predicament. For example, in 2012, there seems every reason to believe that the Republican pollsters in the U.S. really believed that Mitt Romney was going to win. They really did. And nobody else did, but they seem to have been genuinely surprised by the fact that he lost. Well, what led them to that? And I think that part of that is that there does tend to be, other things equal, a little bit of a tendency for polling firms to want to bring good news to their client. Mm. It's up to the client to see through that to the extent that that happens. That said, I'd still trust a party poll as long as it's not made public.
Right.
My guessing is that their internal polling is actually pretty good, though a lot of their polling is not just about how they're standing overall in the horse race. They tend to do pretty deep polling on the substance of questions. So, for example, if they think there is a negative ad, that will be potentially helpful. They might capture the verbal essence of the ad in a question and put that to their test sample to see what the reaction is.
Right.
And if it's the right kind of reaction, well, then that becomes the kernel for an ad.
Right.
If it produces backlash, and there's various ways of picking this up inside a survey. If there's backlash, well, that's an ad you probably won't see.
Yeah. And I guess, like you said, you know, parties, their incentive is to get accurate polls so that they can, you know, win. It's to their advantage. But there is this chance of them inflating their own.
Yeah, nobody likes bad news.
Yeah.
Part of it is, it's not entirely stupid. It's not, nor entirely kind of naive.
Mm-hmm.
You want your volunteers and you want your staffers to be enthusiastic, right? Mm-hmm. You want them to get out there and work for you and get up in the morning approaching their tasks with enthusiasm. What you don't want to do is cultivate a sense of inevitability and defeat in your own team. So, you know, you're not necessarily as explicit about this stuff in the semi-public conversation around the campaign. You might be very explicit in the kind of war room, so to speak, you know, the room where you're not allowed to bring your cell phone in, that sort of thing.
Right. That's very interesting. So considering what we've talked about today, I just wanted to ask this final question. So polls, depending on how they're done, can produce different results if they're done by phone or by internet survey, and their effect can incentivize folks to vote out of fear or for strategic reasons. So do you think if we were to try to achieve kind of a fairer election where people vote for who they actually want to be elected, regardless of how other people are voting or what their chances are of getting into office, do you think that could be accomplished if we sort of banned polls? Or
I'm absolutely opposed to banning polls.
Okay.
I mean, first of all, it's a freedom of speech issue.
Right.
And you better have a good reason for that. And what you've put together is a kind of a tissue of weak considerations. That's the first thing I'd say. The second thing is the meaning of whom you really want to vote for. We have a first-past-the-post system in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. No, there can be only one mayor, for starters, right? So right away, it's a single-member district as far as the mayor is concerned. And it's probably unlikely that we would get into polling about council because there's just too many town councillors. But mm-hmm. thinking of the mayor here, you know, most people may have concrete preferences for this party over that party, or this candidate over that candidate. But there's also some more general sense in which there is a overarching policy orientation. Think of it as left versus right. Now, voters may not be able to tell you everything about the content of that, but there's a sort of general orientation, you know, kind of pro-anti-developer, pro-anti-density, stuff like that. So you have an overarching orientation, but there's more than one candidate who represents that orientation. And you may not actually have much concrete information about which of those candidates is actually closer to you if you knew where you were. I mean, honestly, Kennedy Stewart, Shauna Sylvester, you know, I see them as largely interchangeable on policy grounds, and I don't actually have a strong basis for differentiating amongst them in terms of, say, their real experience or ability. So, but let's just say one or the other of them would be acceptable and none of the others would be. Under those circumstances, I'm probably going to pay attention to poll information. And it's a perfectly rational thing to do.
Right.
If you had a different ballot, right? If, for example, you had a preferential ballot where you were given the option of ranking all the candidates for mayor, such that if your first preference is not viable, you have some reasonable prospect that your ballot will then be assigned to your second preference, who may be viable and certainly more acceptable to you than all the alternatives. In that situation, you can be completely sincere.
Right?
But in the kind of system that we're working with, sincerity is the road to perdition.
Right, but isn't sincerity...
You do have to pay attention.
Right, but isn't sincerity also sort of synonymous with saying fairer, like a fairer election where people are voting for who they actually want? Like, would our election be fairer if we had a preferential or proportional representation system on the municipal level?
Well, proportional representation would mean nothing in the selection of the mayor, right? In the direct election of a mayor...
That's true.
It's a single-member district. It's a single office. So the fairer thing there, I would say, is a preferential ballot,
mm-hmm.
right? So you have an inescapably majoritarian choice. There can be only one winner. Now, if you're talking about council, that's a different story, right? Council has 10 seats,
yeah,
and that's a situation where you could actually start talking about divvying up the vote or divvying up what might otherwise be big coalitions into, or big tents into smaller ones that could then get together for policy purposes. But that's about a multi-member body like council, parks board, or school board. And I actually think there's a strong argument for proportional representation there, provided that you have room for independence. But it is the case that in Vancouver, we do have a party system. It may be in flux, but we've had parties in municipal politics for a long time. And where you have real parties, then you can actually start talking about proportional representation. That would be fairer in the sense that there would be a cleaner relationship, a more proportionate relationship between the kind of depth of sentiment on the ground and its representation in the council. But that's another phone call.
Right. Absolutely. So I guess just in this election, with polls that we have available to us, it will likely influence who is voted in for our mayor, as it is a single person office, as you said. And so moving forward, if we want to give our electorate more accurate information, we would want to have more credible pollsters and better coverage of the polls through media outlets.
I agree with almost all of what you say. I think in terms of the impact of the polls, it's a potential, right? Mm. It's entirely conceivable that the polls are merely just reflecting a reality and not further shaping it. We do know, however, I mean, I've done quite a bit of work on this, actually, that when you get these in parliamentary context, for example, where you have parties competing for the same voters, there is often an impact, or there can be, and there certainly often has been, an impact from poll-type information somewhere.
Right.
May not always actually be from the right place, but people do take it into account.
Right.
It's in the nature of a first-past-the-post system that this will happen.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Professor Johnston. I appreciate your time.
Okay, you're welcome.
And we are back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. You just heard an interview with political scientist Richard Johnston on the effects polling could have on Vancouver's 2018 municipal election. We're now turning to the topic of wrongful convictions in Canada. Tuesday, October 2nd, is the day wrongfully convicted exonerees reflect on how far they have come since being convicted of crimes they had no part in. But Wrongful Conviction Day is not only a time to increase awareness about past ordeals. It is also a time to consider the effects of wrongful convictions on those close to the wrongfully accused, as well as the implications for society in general. Though Innocence Canada has helped to exonerate 21 wrongfully accused since 1993, there are many more who have not yet had their day of justice. This week, I spoke with Tamara Levy of the Innocence Project Canada, who was part of a wrongful conviction talk on campus last week. Here's what she had to say.
My name is Tamara Levy, and I've been the director of the UBC Innocence Project for the last 12 years. I'm a lawyer who practiced in the criminal defense area and the prosecution side for about 5 years before I started teaching at the law school.
So we will get right into questions. So just last week today, which is Tuesday for those of you listening live, the UBC Innocence Project put on an event with UBC UNICEF and the UBC Pre-Law Society. You and Marilyn Sanford, the lawyer of Ivan Henry, for those who don't know, who spent 27 years in jail for a crime he did not commit, were speakers. Does the Innocence Project usually put on events like these often?
This particular event was put on by Innocence Canada to celebrate or recognize Wrongful Conviction Day, which started a number of years ago, and they asked me to speak. The project, you know, may or may not put on events on Wrongful Conviction Day in the future. We're a pretty small shop, so I leave it to the bigger organizations to organize those types of events. I'm happy to speak at them if need be. And next year, you know, perhaps I can put a student on organizing something along the same lines.
So is there an effort in the sort of innocence community, if you will, to raise a lot of public awareness of false convictions? Do you think more public awareness would be helpful?
In the States, there's a huge push to raise public awareness about the issue, and I think they've done a pretty great job. The Innocence Project in New York and the over 60 organizations in the United States have a lot of recognition by government, by the prosecution offices down there. They work with what are called down there conviction integrity units within the prosecution services, and they work together to review claims of wrongful convictions in some states. Some states have those sorts of units. And the FBI works with the Innocence Project in the United States to address certain failures or challenges in the justice system. For example, they're working on a project together on hair microscopy. That was about 2 years ago, I suppose, the beginnings of it in any case. In Canada, I think the situation is quite different. There's not a lot of public awareness around wrongful convictions in Canada. It's often seen as an American problem and not something that we face here for a variety of reasons. People hold that opinion. There are no doubt differences between the two countries. We have a tenth of the population. We don't send people to jail for quite as long or nearly as long. We don't have elected officials, so there's not quite as much pressure on the prosecution and the judge to convict in cases perhaps where it's not warranted. So there are absolutely differences in our system that would affect the number of wrongful convictions. That said, we rely in many cases on the same kinds of evidence that have been identified as the causes of wrongful conviction in the United States. And I think that because we have so few people working in this area in Canada, we're really at the tip of the iceberg in terms of recognizing where these wrongful convictions have occurred, not just with the very serious offenses, but even with the summary conviction lower level offenses.
So sort of building on what you're saying a little bit with the public awareness differences in Canada and the United States, have you seen in the United States sort of the court of public opinion, as it's called, being a hindrance or helpful to wrongful conviction situations? And would you sort of want the public to be more involved here in Canada? Do you think that would be a helpful thing?
Yeah, I think that it's probably been helpful. There have been numerous high-profile cases and a number of celebrities that have jumped on board to raise awareness. You know, John Grisham, I believe, sits on the board of the Innocence Project in New York, and a number of singers have, you know, come forward to support the cause. You know, we only have to look as far as the case of Brian Banks, for example, who was a football player, you know, star high school football player, who was wrongly accused and convicted of a sexual assault and later exonerated. You know, that's a case that people can relate to because he was just your everyday high school athlete that was unfortunately wrongly accused for the wrong reasons by somebody of this crime. But cases like that where high-profile or potentially high-profile individuals are wrongly accused certainly bring attention to the issue. And when they're exonerated, it brings even more attention and shines a light on those failures in the justice system where things have gone wrong.
All right. So do you see any overrepresented demographics amongst those who've been falsely accused?
Certainly in the United States, there's overrepresentation of African American males in the system. And in Canada, the numbers are too few, I think, at the moment to talk about a particular demographic where wrongful convictions occur, because I suspect that given the number of incarcerated Indigenous people in Canada and the overrepresentation of Indigenous people in the prison population, I suspect that there are way more wrongly convicted Indigenous offenders than we see in those that have been exonerated, partially because I think that for numerous cultural reasons, those individuals don't come forward screaming about their innocence, and sometimes may not be readily believed for a variety of reasons within the system. And you don't see the numbers of Indigenous people in that wrongly convicted population in Canada that I suspect is more representative of a true number.
So we don't have a totally clear picture, but it's certainly looking like Indigenous people are falsely convicted at higher rates, you would say.
If you're looking at the same sort of systemic issues of racism that they've seen in the States, that we certainly experience here with our Indigenous population, as they do in the States with an African American population. Obviously, many of the issues are different, but the underlying racism is similar. I would suspect there are higher numbers than we have seen here so far.
Do you think the justice system needs to do more to prevent false convictions from occurring? And what would preventative measures look like, do you think, if any?
The justice system certainly could be doing more in a variety of areas that have been identified as the causes of wrongful conviction. If we go through them, mistaken identification, certainly there could be improvements in the way that we do photographic identification. New Jersey has implemented some guidelines that are sort of best practices that worked with the Innocence Project to develop those. False confessions is another area that has been identified as a cause of wrongful convictions, particularly coming from individuals who lack education or have a mental disability or are young, and protections need to be put in place for individuals like that when they are giving statements. And I have to say that improvements have certainly been made over the last 20 years in dealing with individuals that have some of those particular challenges in the justice system. But when you're looking at wrongful convictions, you're looking at cases going back. So we're talking about prevention now, so I'm talking about what more could be done. But the focus of our work is looking back at cases where things were not done properly. Other areas where prevention, and I think this is probably the biggest area where we can look at prevention, is forensic science and shoring up our statistics and the foundations of forensic science to ensure that it's as reliable as we would want it to be in a criminal case.
So at a glance, it would seem that a lot of wrongfully convicted people have been serving time for decades or a good deal of years before their names are cleared. Why do exonerations seem to take so long?
The average length of time in the United States is 8 to 12 years to exonerate an individual. In Canada, I don't think there have been studies to look at the numbers, but I can just say anecdotally from the project's experience, we have cases we've been working on for 10 years and they're not yet through the system. They are very onerous, work intensive cases, you know, with a lot of documents. And the number one challenge is identifying what documents would have existed at the time. And when you're looking back 20 or 30 years, you can imagine how difficult that may be. Most people don't have their documents anymore. If they do have their documents, they may be scattered between a number of different individuals. So even putting the file together to determine what was available can take us a number of years. The second factor from the work that we do is that we only have students working on these files maybe 5 to 10 hours a week. You know, it's certainly not a full-time endeavor. And if you look at the recommendations that have been made in many of the commissions of inquiry into wrongful convictions that have occurred in Canada, they have recommended that it would be in the best interests of those claiming wrongful conviction that we have an independent body that would focus solely on looking at these claims and investigating these claims. We currently have what is known as the Criminal Convictions Review Group in Ottawa, which reviews claims made under a section of the Criminal Code, 696.1 of the Criminal Code, and that's a particular section that allows review by the minister where somebody is claiming that a miscarriage of justice occurred. I believe they only have 4 or 5 lawyers working in that office, and to be frank, I don't know what the holdup is. You know, they work full-time, and we submitted a case 2.5 years ago that we still haven't got even a preliminary decision on. And I know they do their best and they're working hard, but I'm not sure why, because in those cases, at least that come from our office, we've spent already 6 or 7 years investigating and putting the file together so that we can hand it over in a form that we hope they can just take and do some quick checks to make sure that what we're saying is true and reliable, and move forward from there. But it's not a process that is very transparent, which is one of the criticisms of the process, because the lawyers in that office are advising the minister, and their advice to the minister is privileged. So you don't always know what advice they've given in any particular case. But it's a very lengthy process, to the extent now that I really think the system is broken and you know, violates some basic charter rights of individuals claiming wrongful conviction, whose liberty is absolutely at stake because they remain incarcerated. So I think it's a huge issue that the wrongful convictions community in Canada needs to come together to address.
Is there a simple it sounds like there's a lot of legwork involved in this kind of thing. Is there a sort of a process, sort of a track that you can go down dealing with these cases of false convictions? Is there any sort of framework? Because it sort of sounds like you're getting all these documents together and you're doing a lot of improvising and being pretty creative in finding these records. So, you know, again, is there sort of just a process that, you know, copy paste that you can do with this, or does that not exist?
It's not a copy paste process. The legislation and the regulations set out what documents are required and what the test for the minister is and what evidence the minister will consider. And it's new and significant evidence that the minister will look at when determining, at least on at a preliminary level, whether a wrongful conviction may have occurred. And getting to that place where you have new and significant evidence is about going back to the day the crime occurred or the incident occurred, in cases where maybe it was an accident, and reinvestigating, not just anything new that maybe the police didn't find or identify or decided not to investigate, but also looking at all of the police work that happened and identifying whether tunnel vision was in play, you know, at play, and only focused on a particular individual and didn't follow up on other potential suspects, or whether corners were cut in other areas, what expert evidence was relied on, what testing was done. A big area is what information was disclosed to the Crown and then to the defense, because in a number of these wrongful conviction cases, failure to disclose has been identified as a significant issue, where the defense didn't have very critical information to work with in cross-examining or challenging the evidence that the Crown was putting forward. So that process of investigating the new information and going back and finding all the witnesses, finding everything the police had, finding everything that was given to the defense and making an inventory and then comparing it to what the police may have had, even getting the information about what the police had may take years of litigation for them to, for the, you know, have a court decision to help decide whether or not you're entitled to that information. We have very little law in Canada around, and we're trying to litigate this, around disclosure and what the obligations of the Crown and the state are in terms of disclosing information at this state of a process, of a criminal law process. You know, my view is that when you have a section of the criminal code that allows conviction review and allows people to say, look, something went wrong, I'm not the person that committed this crime, if we recognize that as a possibility, you must have allowances within the system for disclosure of information that's going to allow somebody to go back and find the evidence that's going to prove that something went wrong. It would be a completely meaningless system if we didn't have that ability.
All right, so that's really complicated. not a cut and dry process. In general, you know, after all this is done and we've got a wrongfully convicted person exonerated, they're out in the world. Have you personally sort of observed their absorption back into society, taking into account, you know, effects of trauma, feelings of isolation and time spent away from the workforce?
I have not observed it, but I know from many of the studies have been done and the thousands, literally thousands of individuals in the United States that have gone through this process, that it's an incredibly difficult reintegration into society. Unlike people who have been convicted correctly and serve time and then have the support of a parole process where they're reintegrated and there's programming and they have the support of the system. When you're wrongly convicted, at least in the States, you know, you're put on a bus and sent your way with no support, no money, and you really only have organizations like the Innocence Project and I think there are a number of other organizations that have developed out of the Innocence Project that help those that have been exonerated reintegrate. But they have to find their way to those organizations, and then those organizations have to raise money to then help individuals, because there's not compensation in every case, and people have been in jail for 30 years or 20 years and have no idea how to operate in the society that they get released into.
I just wanted to sort of touch on a principle in justice and law, and I'm sure you're very sure you're familiar with it, Blackstone's principle, that it's better 10 guilty people go free than one innocent serve time in prison. How strong is that sentiment in the profession of law right now, you know, among prosecutors as well as defense lawyers, and do you think it's strong enough?
I think that people certainly pay lip service to that principle, and nobody working in the system would say that they would want to see an innocent person go to jail. However, in practice, that principle can be lost for a variety of reasons that, you know, have been identified, you know, outside pressures, you know, high-profile crime, a desire to to win, to convict, which is not the proper role of the Crown. You know, the Crown is supposed to act as a mini minister of justice and present evidence before the court in a fair and impartial manner. And that is usually the case. And most Crown Counsel I know are excellent and fair. But those principles can get lost in the you know, in the heat of a case or the you know, the quick pace of some of these cases in the justice system. And certainly when you're going back 20 or 30 years, corners were cut in certain ways that we've seen in wrongful conviction cases to achieve a goal, a goal that everybody thought was the right goal. You know, there's something called noble cause corruption that we talk about in wrongful convictions, where the police think they have the right guy, they want to get the bad guy and put them in, you know, in jail, which is, of course, a noble cause. But to do that, sometimes things have been missed. And in missing those small things, the wrong person has ended up in jail.
So people are coming from the right place. It's mostly down to human error. Would you say that's fair?
I think that's absolutely fair. And even when corners are cut, I don't think that's done in a conscious manner to get the wrong guy. Corners are cut because they believe they're doing the right thing.
All right, so my last question is specifically about you and the UBC Innocence Project, which you co-founded. How's this journey been for you? Like, what kind of lessons do you think you've learned? I mean, I know it's over 10 years, but if you could kind of summarize your feelings just a little bit on how it's been going.
Yeah, it's been an incredible journey. I've been humbled by it. I've enjoyed it. It's been exciting. It remains exciting. I think we're just at the tip of the iceberg in terms of the work that needs to be done in Canada to identify wrongful convictions and prevent them going forward. So it's an exciting area, and I love the contact that I have with the students, and they keep me motivated every year. They're so enthusiastic and bring fresh eyes to the cases. We've certainly had cases where we've thought that there's just nowhere else to go, and a new student will come and open a different file or a different box and say, hey, what about this? And we think, wow, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And we go down that road. And it's wonderful to see students who've come out of first-year criminal law excited about what they've learned, you know, a bit curious that, you know, criminal law is something that they really are drawn to, where they never thought they would be. And their eyes get opened over the course of the year in looking at the case and looking at the file. And at the end of the year, they just think, there's nothing else I want to do other than this work. And I have to tell them, this is the best it gets. You know, this is the best work you're ever going to have. It's always interesting. It's a whodunit in every case. You know, so it's they're fascinating files, and they really feel like they're doing meaningful work in trying to help somebody. And they have contact with usually the prisoner or the convicted individual, and they're really inspired by it. And I hope that inspiration and that ability to keep an open mind and always challenge the evidence and always question the evidence that's presented by the prosecution stays with them in no matter, you know, what area of law they decide to practice.
Well, thank you so much, Tamara. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me.
There's only one way that old clunker is going to make you feel good again. Donate it to Bullying Canada. Check this out. Free towing or pickup of your old vehicle, a tax-deductible receipt, and a super easy process. Online at bullyingcanada.ca. Get rid of that old vehicle and feel good about supporting real solutions for change in your community. Donate your old or used vehicle to Bullying Canada today. Full details online at bullyingcanada.ca.
Love. Last year, over 650 BC teens aged out of foster care without a permanent family.
Adoption is not just for babies. Teens need families too. Only 24 teens in BC were adopted last year.
November is Adoption Awareness Month. To find out more about adopting a teen, contact the Adoptive Families Association of BC. Call 1-877-ADOPT-07 or visit us at bcadopt.com.
You know what's better than reading a great magazine? Reading a great magazine that also helps you fight poverty. Megaphone Magazine is sold by homeless and low-income vendors on the streets of Vancouver and Victoria. Vendors buy magazines for 75 cents and sell them for $2. It's flexible, low-barrier work for people who may not have access to traditional jobs. Download the Megaphone app to find vendors and buy the magazine, even when you don't have change.
Hello, and we're back. You are listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM, your source of local news on Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. So we just delved into wrongful convictions in Canada, and we're now going to return back to Vancouver's 2018 election, where we started. So there are only 9 days until the municipal election, which is crazy, so soon. So this year, the city amended a bylaw to allow for more mobile voting sites. So what this means is the city is putting more effort into bringing voting to actual physical locations for people who might otherwise not be physically able to go to a polling station or might not feel comfortable or welcome going to a polling station. So this year, they expanded to more sites that include social services that help people who are facing barriers, not just physical barriers. So people who might be facing addiction issues or other things like that. So this Wednesday, news reporters Lyndon Wong and Samuel Jones, who are in studio with me now, went to two mobile voting stations to speak with voters about the effectiveness of these mobile voting sites, in their opinion. So Lyndon and Sam are here with me now, as I said, and if you guys, one of you wants to tell me which voting locations you actually visited.
Yeah, so we visited a total of two locations yesterday, the UBC Hospital and a care center at Amica at Arbutus Manor.
Okay, cool. So can you tell me of your impression of the first location you visited, which was a hospital?
Yeah, well, it was a little bit underwhelming. So the hospital at UBC that we visited was virtually left untouched during the entire hour that it was open, with really minimal turnout. Like, in terms of accessibility, it was pretty difficult to locate the actual voting station, as it really wasn't at the entrance, and there was no signage or information really pertaining to where or when the voting was. And, you know, because it was located in a hospital, it really wasn't that accessible or welcoming. Like, even for patients, there wasn't that much information to get them out to vote. Mm-hmm. So in terms of that, I don't think it was that accessible.
Right. That does seem disappointing. And did you guys see anyone voting? Like, what span of time were you there for?
We were there for, I think, like 25 minutes, sort of standing in the hallways, examining, seeing. We couldn't get too close. So we were just sort of seeing who came and who went. We saw one person go to vote in the 25 minutes we were there. We saw one person. And considering it's only open for an hour, I mean, that does say something. In fairness, maybe some more people turned up, but I doubt it, personally.
Yeah. It was only open for an hour?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool.
At least that's that's the information that I received, yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So then you left the hospital and you went to Arbutus Manor, which is a care center for elderly folks. So were there more people there, and were those people easier to talk to?
Yeah, well, there were more people voting at the care center compared to the hospital. And although they were reluctant to discuss after voting, we still managed to get some people to comment on kind of their experience with mobile voting.
Okay.
Yeah, so we talked to some folks. When I asked about the effectiveness of mobile voting and the many candidates on the ballot more generally, a lady and a man had this to say.
I'm sure we could. It's the most unorganized voting system I've ever seen.
Unorganized? So what do you mean by that exactly?
Well, I mean, they're all there. And what are we doing? We're all sitting around waiting to vote, and you don't know who you're voting for, and the list is a mile long, and you have to go down through it to do your work.
Right. No, it's dumb. Sharp today. The voting wasn't sharp today. In the past, they've been pretty good, you know. We go in through there, but it's been well organized. It seems a bit scattered now.
Oh, does it?
Oh, yes, and then all these things with the dots that we've got to put in, I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
But then on the other hand, we're getting older. When we were younger, we knew the mayors and knew a lot of them. Now,
well, in fairness to you, there's 21 people running for mayor, right? Like, do you guys find the sheer number of politicians running for
it's
council,
amazing.
Parks Board?
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. Because one of the former mayors was my neighbor, for heaven's sake. I knew him well.
Oh, who was that?
I've forgotten the name. I'm 93 now.
All right. Well, those were some folks at the Arbutus Manor Care Center. And I think the woman who was there, who did she? She mentioned she wanted to vote for Sam, someone not in this election.
She mentioned that she had a vested interest in voting for Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's confusing on the municipal level, right? Like, there's so many people running, and just traditionally, people don't know as much about municipal elections as they do about federal or provincial elections. So I think that those two folks really reflected that. I didn't think it was surprising to hear that, like, the ballot was long and confusing. I think regardless of whether you're a senior or whoever you are, it's a super long ballot. Like, it's super confusing. There's no way you can know all the independent candidates and all the council candidates, you know, really thoroughly. Like, I've been covering this election for, like, the last few months, and I can't tell you all the independents, you know? So I didn't think that was surprising. But I was surprised to hear that she thought the mobile voting itself was poorly run at this care center. So from you two being outsiders looking in, what were your observations?
So I think that as far as just the one at Amica, I think it was a pretty well run. In fairness to them, they had lots of seating outside for the residents to sit and wait. The staff were helpful, showing them where to go. I think that it was, you know, like the election itself might be unorganized, and there may be a very unreasonably long ballot. But I think that the people at the voting station at Amica itself, I think they did a good job. You know, I do.
Okay, so you think what that lady was saying was maybe more reflective of the actual ballot than the process?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what she meant, but that's definitely what I think personally, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's mostly to do with, like, the access to all the candidates and what positions they're running for, because there's just so many.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we ended up seeing that, like, the ballot itself was large, like, it was overwhelming for them. And I think a lot of this is basically the source of all these issues. And, you know, additionally, like, not a lot of information is kind of given to people who aren't really into politics or that who don't keep up with it. So I think that also kind of lends itself to just confusion. Like, honestly, like, compared to the hospital, the center at Amica was actually pretty well run.
Mm-hmm.
Like, honestly, there were a lot of people. There was a good turnout in terms of that area. So I think mostly it's to do with how really we're going to really present who's running and clearly show who they're voting for, because they handed us, like, this map, and it was just a list of names,
mm-hmm.
like, without any context.
Right, and this tape you got, I think I heard that actually the mayors were just among all the candidates, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Like, it was a list.
It was, like, separated by where they were from, I think.
Okay.
Where they were, yeah, and I'm not sure.
Mm. Yeah, we'll have to take a look over that list. I think you can find it online to prepare for voting. So that's always a good idea, to go to the City of Vancouver's website and plan your vote before you go there. Because if you just show up, yeah, you're looking at this long list and it's probably hard to figure it out. But anyway, let's maybe talk. Let's talk a bit more about the election and also in terms of the election, like what issues the folks at this care center had on the top of their mind. So let's go to this one clip you guys have of a gentleman you spoke with.
So would you mind just telling me what is, so you talked about the bridges earlier. Is that the most concerning issue for you in this election?
Well, my most concern, I don't know, bridges and infrastructure. It seems to a lot of damage is being done with car accidents. I'd like to see more greening, and I'm worried about all the fires, and I'm worried about all the animals and the creatures like that. That's my big worry.
Okay.
I give heavily to the animals, and no, it's changing. We're getting more fires, I think, and more violence. And more everything.
Yeah.
No, things are changing.
All right. So that was one gentleman's opinion. Yeah, Sam, what did you think of that?
Well, it did seem like, I talked to a couple other people. It seemed like there was a focus on infrastructure, for sure.
Right,
bridges,
definitely.
Roads. Although, like, none of them mentioned sort of the infrastructure candidate, I would say, in this election, Wei. None of them seemed to mention Wei. It was support for the MPA by and large. There was, you know, concern over climate change, though, as we heard with the last person we talked to.
Right.
There. Yeah.
And that it seems kind of paradoxical to me that someone would be conservative but also want to vote for the Green Party. What do you guys think of that? Does it seem paradoxical?
Yeah, well, we know like the Green Party has been doing really well in polling this election, and actually people on all sides of the political spectrum tend to vote green. They aren't
right.
necessarily socially progressive, although they're environmentally progressive. Like I think one of the people we interviewed, he also talked that he would always vote green. Mm-hmm. as a second choice. So, you know, it's always kind of been a popular choice, but I think it's really increased with this kind of new system of more independence.
I would also say that because the provincial Greens have really blown expectations out of the water by maintaining a government with the NDP, that there's probably greater confidence in them on the municipal level. And I think climate change is slowly but surely becoming less of a partisan issue.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, it definitely seems like that's the case. Yeah. And also, like, I would say that a vote for the Green Party seems to be, like from my observations, a bit more of either like a protest vote or a sort of hopeful vote. Because if you think about it, all the other parties, like there are new parties in the municipal level, but on the provincial and federal level, there's only really one party that hasn't kind of screwed things up yet. And so, and everyone, you know, even if you're conservative, I'm sure you can still say you care about the environment. So it's kind of like, it makes sense to give your one vote to them because maybe they won't screw it up. And, you know, all the other parties have maybe let you down. So I guess it sort of makes sense.
Yeah, it's something I can definitely see.
Right. Well, so we have one last clip of your time at this care center. So let's go to that.
If you'd like, would you like to tell us your name? Or would you like to tell us your name? Would you be interested
Jack
in doing that?
Lennington.
All right. Thanks for talking to us, Jack.
Okay.
So I just want to ask you a few questions. Have you voted a lot? Or is this sort of a one-off?
Every time I need to vote provincially or municipality or city-wise, I vote, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So has... this sort of setup here in the home itself, has this made it easier for you to vote? Are you Absolutely. Really happy about this?
Yeah.
Sweet. Okay, so do you...
If I had to go to a polling station, I wouldn't do it.
No?
No.
All right. So this is really a one-stop shop for you then, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, great. So how do you feel about the amount of candidates to choose from? Do you think you've had the opportunity as a voter to make an informed decision?
I think it's ridiculous. They should make them pay a fee to become a candidate.
And how, did you have a ballpark sort of where you'd put that fee at?
At least $500.
Yeah, okay. So can I ask you what issue is most concerning to you in this election? Are you comfortable sharing that?
Well, basically, I was in the road construction business, paving most of the Vancouver streets.
Okay.
So streets and bridges were top priority for me, yeah.
So would you be comfortable sharing at all what candidate sort of spoke to you on that issue? What party you were more sort of inclined towards? Or is that a little too personal?
There's just one party.
Just one party?
Yep. Do you want to know which one?
I'd love to, if you wouldn't mind sharing.
The NPA. And if there's not enough NPA candidates, I vote Green.
You vote Green, okay.
Yeah.
Can you... Would you mind telling us why you'd choose Green secondary to the NPA?
Well, because all my life I voted NPA, mm-hmm. and when there wasn't enough names, I picked one Green member that I knew and voted for her.
Oh, sweet. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very
You're
much.
Welcome.
I very much appreciate you speaking
okay.
to us. It's very good to hear from you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I would bet my life that one Green candidate he's referring to is Adrian Carr, who is an incumbent councillor and very popular in this election. Again, we're seeing this interesting combination of conservative people voting and then giving their extra votes to the Greens. Very interesting. I also wanted to comment on how Sam had said that, yeah, like it's interesting that infrastructure is a topic for these older folks. And that's just like a traditionally municipal issue that no one who's young, who I know, is talking about at all, right? Like, I have not heard one person be like, yeah, like, man, I want to vote for someone who is going to pave the roads quickly and do it well. Like, that's not on anyone's mind who's, I mean, I shouldn't speak for everyone, but that's not on most young people's mind. And also, it's interesting to hear that among these, like, you know, we heard about four voices from this care center this evening. Not one of them mentioned the affordability crisis. Easily the biggest crisis in this election. It's pretty interesting.
I think one thing to keep in mind there is that they're living in a home. A lot of them have mobility issues. They're in an area where homelessness is just not rearing its head in Vancouver, and so they're probably quite insulated from that
right.
particular issue.
Very good point, though I would say, like, people are concerned about it for, like, their relatives or extended family. So, for example, you know, the housing crisis affects me as a young person, but, like, my parents have a house and they've bought it, so it doesn't affect them, but they're concerned for me. So it's possible, like, some of these folks might have grandkids who would be affected, but it wasn't really brought up. But you're right. I think in their direct lives, it makes sense that the affordability crisis isn't really something their generation has to worry about as much.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I will point out, again, is in their immediate area, mm-hmm. there is construction currently going on. Mm-hmm. And it has affected the roads.
Okay.
So it is possible that could have something to do with why they're focused on infrastructure so much, although it is mm-hmm. way more likely that it's just, you know, traditional municipal politics.
But that's a good point, and that's also sort of a case for wards, right? Is like people traditionally have voted, or not traditionally, but in most places in Canada, in most major cities, there's wards, meaning there's geographical districts that you vote in. So you vote about issues in your neighborhood. So say in your neighborhood, there's a ton of construction and it's bothering you, you would vote for someone who would address that issue.
Right.
So you might be right. Like, that might be a very hyper local issue that's on the top of these folks' minds. But yeah, we got a bit off topic. I think, Sam, did you have other observations?
Well,
just, you know, same as you, that it was interesting to see another combination of a conservative vote paired with a green vote. What I think that is going to be really, what I can't stop thinking about is that on the right, you've got a lot of parties, and so the vote's going to get split.
Right.
But if we keep on seeing this trend where, you know, lots of conservatives are saying, well, my second vote's green.
Right.
Then they're only voting for one party. One party. And,
well, what do you mean, for mayor or for
council? Oh, they're only voting. They only have one green party to vote for, is
right.
what I'm saying.
Sorry.
So, yeah, so what I was trying to say there is that, you know, if you've got a bunch of people voting for different conservative parties, but their second vote's green, and that's who they're deferring to with their extra votes, that's just one party that's going to get all of that trickle down. Yep.
Totally. Yeah, definitely. As the polls have suggested, this is looking like it's going to be a really good election for Vancouver's Green Party, even as like kind of a traditional second choice. Just the amount of votes that they're getting seems to be like a really good recipe for success for them.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I wonder if on the left, though, so if we went to an area where more people voted on the left and were more progressive, perhaps a younger demographic, perhaps just a different geographical region, because this was in South Vancouver, right?
South Vancouver, pretty sort of like a few major streets before we get into the east side.
Okay. Yeah. So I wonder if on the left, if the sort of default second choice is the Green Party as well. So that's something we should look into. But anyways, yeah. Thank you both for your reporting and for talking with me. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in again. We had an extra long show today. Lucky you. Only a few technical hiccups. And if you liked the show today, please keep tuning in. We're here every Thursday at 5 p.m. bringing you local news.
Also, don't forget to vote on October 20th. And if you want to learn more about this election, please check out our election podcast, Seeking Office. You can download it on anywhere you get your podcasts.
Yeah, yeah. And in addition to voting, also come by our election night viewing party on the same day as voting. On October 20th, it's at the Lido, and we'll be
Lido. It's at the Lido.
Oh, Lido. Okay, and we'll be doing some election trivia and watching the election results come in live. There's also a Facebook event, so you can check us out if you're interested.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Lido is just to give you a sense of where it is in the city. It's on Broadway, close to Fraser, near Fraser. So, yeah, come on by. We're going to be projecting the election results on the wall as like a local TV news broadcaster airs them, so it's going to be exciting. We can all have some drinks, cry into our drinks, celebrate. Whatever happens will happen. If you check out CITR on social media, you'll find a Facebook event. If you go to Seeking Office on Facebook or Twitter, you'll find some info on this election night. Thank you so much for listening. This has been Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Stay tuned for more local programming.